Good afternoon, everybody. My name is PJ, and I'm an alcoholic and an atheist, and I will be your host for this session. And welcome to you all. I'd like to begin by saying a big thank you to the organizers of this event, putting an amazing and diverse event schedule together and making it possible for all of us to attend here today. As hosts, my job is to give you a brief outline of what we will be presenting to you today. Our session is all about a book called We're Not All Egomaniacs, Adapting the 12 Steps for Alcoholics with Low Self-Esteem by Beth H. And this is the book here if you haven't seen it. If, as the title of the book describes, you are not an egomaniac and have low self-esteem, then this is probably a book that you will find helpful for your recovery, as I have. Our session will be divided into three parts, beginning with Beth, the author, giving us a talk about the book. Then I will follow with a talk about our AA meeting based on the book, how it started, what it has achieved, and what I hope to see it achieve in the future. Then our group will run a slightly modified version of our weekly meeting for you, the audience, to experience. Okay, that's the introduction done, and now it's time for Beth to talk to us about her book. Thank you, Beth.
Hi, I'm Beth. I'm an alcoholic. I'm afraid some of you probably just heard me on the author's panel, and so you're going to get a bit of a repeat. I got sober in regular AA, and I had a really hard time with the God stuff, but it wasn't just that. They were telling me I'm selfish, self-centered. I'm an egomaniac. I try to tell other people what to do. I like to be the director. I just was not relating to those things. But, you know, in regular AA, you couldn't really say that. I mean, it was hard. I was still struggling with the God thing so much that I was afraid to pipe up and say, I don't agree with this part either. And to tell you the truth, I had such a weak sense of self when I got here. I had no idea that I had grown up in a dysfunctional family until I went to treatment. I never spent a day feeling sorry for myself or thought I was being abused. But I was gaslighted a lot. I mean, I think both of my parents were more like the Bill type personality. They were never wrong. So if something went wrong, it was my fault. It was never theirs. And I just learned to accept the blame for everything, even if I had no control over it. I was gaslighted a lot, like, you don't really think that. Mom, I'm hungry. No, you're not. That's just appetite. Mom, I hurt. No, you're not. You're just trying to get attention. Mom, I think I'm sick. No, you're just seeking sympathy. And so I had a really weak sense of self. I didn't trust my own instincts at all to guide me because they had been I had been told they were wrong all the time. And I was a bit of a shrinking violet because I was afraid of getting hurt. I did not put myself out there. I thought the whole world was just kind of lying in wait, waiting for me to screw up so they could make fun of me. These are the attitudes that I carried from my family of origin out into the world. Needless to say, they were not leading me to a healthy, productive life. I mean, I was so self-conscious that when I discovered alcohol, it was like a miracle elixir. Now I can like actually totally exhale, you know? So after I'd been sober a long time and dealt with the God stuff and working on myself, I eventually came to see that Bill wrote the book for a particular type of alcoholic, which he and many of the early AA members were, and that was fine. It's fine that they have a book that's for them, but it just doesn't apply to, it didn't apply to me. And I started sharing about it little bits, mostly in secular meetings, because you're not supposed to say anything that's against the big book in regular meetings. So once I discovered secular AA, I was actually allowed to talk. And at the Toronto conference, I gave sort of a test flight of this idea that not everyone has Bill's personality. And rather than needing to have our egos crushed, we may actually need to learn how to build them up a little bit. And I got a lot of positive feedback from that. And then there was a pandemic, so I wrote a book. I don't know. So this book is not for everyone. It's not, you don't have to be secular to read it. I'm secular. So I certainly don't push God on anyone, but I don't mind if somebody's using a higher power to stay sober. I just wrote it for, you know, a lot of us have had some sort of childhood trauma of one form or another. We don't even recognize it. A lot of it is emotional abuse, which we don't have any physical scars. We don't think we were abused, but we didn't learn healthy ways of handling our feelings because, number one, what's a feeling? And number two, don't talk about it. You know, so after I sort of worked through these issues for myself, I had found out that I wasn't the only one. I just wrote this book for maybe a very small subset, I don't know, of people in AA that were actually, I mean, I was actually damaged by the big book. It was gaslighting me, telling me who I am, which was not who I am. It was making me feel, it was triggering my shame, like I'm controlling. Well, that's horrible. You should never be controlling. I'm selfish. That's horrible. You should never be selfish. You know, so I just wrote the book for, in case there were other people like me that had a, you know, needed something different from working the 12 steps than exactly what people like Bill get out of them. So, like I say, it isn't for everyone. It's just if you, and, you know, there are many ways that people respond to trauma, or even if you just want to call it emotional abuse like that. But Bill, one of the ways is fight. Like, I vow to dominate everything. And that was Bill. But that was not me. Other people do the flight. Other people do the freeze. I did the placate and appease everyone and stay small. And that's called fawning. So the four F's. So I wrote a book for the people that are like me, that sacrificed themselves and their authentic self in order to feel safe in their environment. And if that's you, you may like the book. If it's not you, the book's not, you know, if you're like Bill, read his book. And if you're if you have a different response, write your own book, because I certainly don't speak for everyone. All right. I mean, I'm not even trying to say there's two categories, like Bill's way or my way. I just offer it for people that do relate. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Beth. Okay. I just want to talk about our meeting. I've got some notes here, just so as I can cover the points. So if you see me looking down, please understand. So I'm going to talk about our meeting that we have, how it came about and what it has achieved so far and what I hope it will do. So a little bit about myself. I got sober in AA in Sydney, New South Wales, in the early 1990s. And I'm very much an AA meeting person, you know. I describe myself as old school Sydney AA without God. And that basically is, don't pick up the fourth drink, go to meetings and try to lend a hand to help others get and stay sober. You know, there was a big book there, don't worry about it, don't worry about the steps. Like, initially, we just got to get you sober. Very much fellowship-driven. You know, it's all about other alcoholics and getting together. And we're going for coffee after the meeting. You come in with us. We're going to a meeting tomorrow night. Are you okay? Like that's my sort of AA. So it's, you know, one alcoholic sharing with another. So a little bit of a background about me is, you know, the most important thing I've learned in AA is the first drink does the damage. And if I don't pick up the first drink, I can't possibly get drunk. And that did two things for me, is it got me sober. And the other thing is it saved my life, because I didn't fully understand what alcoholism was or is, and I still don't. But I've known a lot of people who, you know, sat with me in meetings and helped me get sober, and they're not around. They picked up a drink and they went back out and didn't come back. And even if someone did, they never came back saying it was fantastic. So, you know, that's what I bear in mind. And I'm still an alcoholic. And I have this thing that will kill me. And it's not obvious all the time. This is why I take this very seriously. So I've always been a meetings person, you know, treasurer, washer-upper, vacuuming floors, waiter taking people to meetings. And for me, they're a natural habitat, you know. I'm very comfortable in the environment of a meeting. I feel safe, comfortable, and have done most of my learning about alcoholism and sobriety. I figured out I was an atheist at 18 years. I'm a bit of a slow learner. But, you know, that's just how long it was for me to realize I'm doing the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, the prayer of St. Francis. And essentially, I figured out I was talking to myself. And that's okay when I'm drunk. But when I'm sober and supposedly sane, that's a bit of a problem. So I stopped doing it. And I kept very quiet because I discovered that as soon as you start to mention that you're an atheist, and this is in Sydney, in a secular country, you know, founded on convicts who don't follow rules and we don't want to learn about religion, I discovered just how religious the AA meetings in Sydney are. So I stopped saying it and I kept really quiet about it. Until 7 years ago, I was in an AA meeting in Florida. This guy said his name was so-and-so. He was an alcoholic and an atheist, did not believe in God and did not need to believe in God to put the principles of the 12 steps into his life. And I thought, wow. Now, the follow-on speaker was a Christian lady who took great offense to him saying this. And she was sitting right beside him. And she turned her face so her mouth or front of her face was side on. And she just gave him this massive broadside and says, you know, I will tolerate Muslims in AA. I will even tolerate Jews in AA. But I won't tolerate atheists. My good Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Now, she had 2 out of 3 intolerance, and 2 out of 3 ain't bad, because that's what Rod Stewart used to sing about. So, but the guy just sat there, and the main thing is, and this is what happened at the meeting, is I had heard him, and then I got online and did a search, and 2 weeks later, I went to my first secular meeting in Berkeley, California, and it was a room full of atheists and agnostics. None of them, you know, none of them believed in God. They were all sober, all shapes and sizes, all ages. And I thought, wow. And that then started the process that led us to be here today, because when I got back to Sydney, I teamed up with a few people and we started a secular meeting. So starting this meeting for me was a natural move, because that's the sort of thing I've done, which is a complete contradiction, because I have massive problems with low self-esteem. And I get very anxious at times. And yes, I've been able to do these things. And that's because of you people. So how the meeting came about is I heard John S. and Beth doing a talk on Beyond Belief Sobriety earlier this year. And I thought, oh, this sounds like me. And I bought the book and I read the book. And then I was thinking, will I want to start the meeting? And they're faffing around. And I'm married to my soulmate, who's not an alcoholic, who knows me very well. And she got sick of it and said, listen, why don't you just start a bloody meeting? So I said, okay, I'll do that. And then I'm thinking, well, no one will want to know and you'll make an idiot of yourself. And they don't want to have to do it anyway. So this is how I still struggle with this low self-esteem. But anyway, I sent out an email and got a strong response to a couple of posts and 2 Facebook pages. I should say I did ask Beth for permission beforehand. That's a good Catholic buy-in. I'll do the right thing and I just make sure, because I don't want to get into trouble. And then I picked the time. It's 10 a.m. on Friday mornings, which is Sydney time, which is Thursday evening or afternoon in North America. So the best of both worlds, he decided. I have to say that having such a well-written book makes it very easy, because, you know, what we do is we just turn the first page. We just keep, you know, like kindergartens could turn the page. So it works really well. And now I may never write a book, but I can run meetings. And what I wanted, my part in this really was to try and replicate the atmosphere of the meetings that I experience in Sydney, which is fellowship, backed safety, laughter, understanding, hope, and that unique feeling of affinity that I have with other alcoholics. And a meeting, you know, could give the book legs and bring it to life in an atmosphere, a meeting atmosphere, which I think it's done. I also wanted participants to feel welcome and comfortable at the meeting, where they feel respected and you can let your guard down. We read the book from beginning to end, start at page 1, And we start with best story, which is right up my alley because I'm from an Irish storytelling background. So our stories as though it's in a general way of what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. My whole life is a story. My sobriety is a story. And, you know, we've just progressed our way through the book. And so, you know, the meeting, what has it achieved? I know I'm not alone. I'm one amongst many. And in a subgroup of AA, I might add. So there's the atheists and agnostics are a subgroup. And then there's the low self-esteem people who are another subgroup. I get to hear other people's perspectives and their different, you know, takes on the readings. And it opens up my mind. And we have grown in number. You know, we've steadily had an increase in participants. So the meeting hopes I've had for the future are find a new host. Done. Jill is going to be the new host. You know, she's taken over. The meeting to continue, which of course it will. And now it's going to be run out of Florida. It's not going to be run out of Sydney. And exposure to a broader audience. Well, we've done that because here we are with 63 participants. So the other thing I hope that you'd have more meetings like this one. To my knowledge, it's the only one on Zoom. I could be wrong, but I don't know of any others. And this is up to you as audience members. I hope from what you hear today, you'll really like it. And you'll say, you know what? We can do something similar. Okay, now next week, 10 a.m. on Friday, Sydney time, we start over on the book, page one. So please join us. That'll be Thursday evening or afternoon. I will post, when the meeting gets going, I will post details in the chat. The websites that have the meeting listed, and most important, we use a contact email so that you can contact us. Before we start the meeting, I'm just going to read you an Australian historical item. And the reason for this is that, as I said before, AA did two things. It got me sober and it saved me life, saved my life. But it did one other thing as well, and it fixed another problem that I had, which a lot of us have, but I thought I would use somebody else's words for this. And this comes from an early Australian AA history book called Castle Shadows, which unfortunately didn't have a print. And we had three co-founders in Australia. One of them was a non-alcoholic, and he was a psychiatric nurse. And he wrote this book. And this is in 1946. So AA started here in 1945. Very early days. They have no service structure. They have no service office. They're essentially a bunch of drunks hanging on to each other for dear life. And they're dropping like flies. It's real desperate stuff. And one of the problems they had was finding some sort of permanent accommodation. Because when they get somewhere, there'll be alcoholics there drinking and drunk. And they'd cause problems, and they kept getting kicked out. And this is about a place called Vianney House, where they stay there for 18 months, and it gives them some stability. And Vianney House is in a street called Favot Street in Sydney, and the chapter is called Favot Street Days. So this is just an excerpt from that chapter. The top floor of the building was used as apartments, and living there were two old ladies, neglected and forgotten, eking out their last days in drabness and soul-destroying dullness, sufferers from a disease which is surely the most dreadful condition that one can suffer from. It attacks mostly the old, but even sometimes the young. It is called loneliness. I find it hard not to cry when I read this. Almost immediately, it all changed as the building started to fill up with men, young and old, from every social level, wanted to talk and would talk to anyone willing to listen. Many brought attractive wives and girlfriends who also wanted to talk. Before they realized what was happening, the two old ladies were involved in the lives of dozens of people. They helped to prepare supper and took part in other activities. Most important of all, they gave a touch of home to many lonely men, and they too began to live again. They cried over the ones who fell by the wayside and rejoiced for those who succeeded. There was always someone dropping in to see them, for Vianney House really became a home and a club for AA. And members with time on their hands climbed the steep Favot Street Hill to see the old ladies. AA enriched their lives and brought happiness to two dear women, such happiness indeed as they had not known for many years. What AA owes to them, same intangible debt, it owes to many other non-alcoholics who, in their various ways, made a contribution to its eventual success. And I hope you feel something like that here today, that you're not alone, you're not the only one, and your loneliness can disappear. Okay, it's meeting time. So now we're going to just have a slightly modified version of our Sydney meeting. And just imagine you've come to Sydney and here you are at the meeting. So good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Ride Eastwood Secular AA meeting called Adapting the 12 Steps for Alcoholics with Low Self-Esteem. My name is PJ and I'm an alcoholic. And I will start off by asking Jill to read our version of the preamble, which is on the back of Beth's book. Thank you, Jill.
Jill, alcoholic. Some people come to Alcoholics Anonymous feeling terrible about themselves and are told, bewilderingly, that their problem is too much ego and a lack of humility. Bill W., who wrote most of the AA literature, described himself as an egomaniac, put his own needs and wants ahead of others, was grandiose, felt entitled, and thought he was all powerful. He called this the alcoholic personality type and designed a program to crush the ego as the foundation of sobriety. It worked for him and millions of other alcoholics like him, and he deserves great credit. Alcoholics who normally put others' needs before their own and see themselves as less than, unentitled, not enough, defective, imposters, losers. Their egos need building, not deflating. This book reframes the 12-step program so people with low self-esteem can grow to feel better rather than worse about themselves. Each step includes exercises to build and strengthen a person's sense of self, to grow from a place of feeling unlovable into a strong, sober person, no longer dependent on alcohol or external validation to feel good.
Thank you, Joe. This meeting aims to provide a safe place where we can honestly and freely share what is going on with us. We listen carefully and respectfully to the person who is sharing to let them know that what they have to say counts. They are understood and respected. And this process of alcoholics sharing and listening, identifying with each other, creates that unique feeling of affinity that we have for each other. All are welcome to attend, whether you believe in the deity, you aren't sure, or you don't believe, because the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. But for anyone who is unsure about the God stuff you hear spoken about at meetings or read about in the literature, we can show you that atheists and agnostics can and do get sober just as well as those with a faith in God. That is to say, as honestly as we can, to the best of our ability, one day at a time. So a few important points. We use adapting the 12 steps for alcoholics with low self-esteem as our guide. Reference is made from time to time to the big book and the 12 by 12. This meeting is not about alternative steps or using related material. If you suffer from any childhood trauma or mental health issue, please seek professional help, as this is beyond the scope of this book or meeting. And I will say on a personal note, I have been feeling very uncomfortable since doing this meeting. And the simple reason is that it's dredging up a few issues that I need to address. So if you're feeling something from this meeting, you may need to seek professional help. We are using a slightly modified format for this afternoon's meeting to give you our broader audience the best possible understanding of how we run it. To that end, we are keeping the reading and commentary within the group members for the duration of the presentation. So at the end of the meeting, we'll have a questions and answers session. Our regular Ride Eastwood meeting attendees have pre-chosen a section of the book to read and when they'll comment on it. So what you want to have is the members have this section about a page and a half. They'll read it first, then it will comment, and we get a few of the members of the group if they would care to add a comment as well, and then move on to the next person. So the first person that we've selected is Jill, please. Thank you, Jill.
Jill, still alcoholic. And I'm reading from Chapter 5, Something That Struck Me. All happy families are alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. There are countless ways for families to be dysfunctional. Happy families are open, honest, expressive, and nurturing. Each person has a secure place that has not been predefined by someone else, but instead allows the individual freedom to grow, learn, and self-define. Children know they are loved even when they misbehave, make mistakes, or act their age. They are not only allowed to have feelings, but taught how to manage them. The adults behave like adults and are good role models. The CDC Kaiser Permanent Adverse Child Effects Experience Child Experiences study was one of the largest investigations ever conducted on child abuse and neglect and its effects on children's health and well-being later in life. One of the study's conclusions, safe, stable, nurturing relationships and environments are essential to prevent early adversity, including child abuse and neglect, and to assure that all children reach their full potential. The Spiritual Experience Appendix to the Big Book stresses that the alcoholic must undergo a psychic change to recover from alcoholism. Our most basic sense of who we are is formed in childhood. We internalize all sorts of messages from our main caretakers even before we are verbal. When a baby cries and no one comes, usually the baby doesn't even bother crying. When a baby is handled roughly, he learns to associate fear and pain with human contact. When the mother has a look of contempt or disgust on her face while tending to the baby learns that she is contemptible or disgusting. A look of annoyance, I must be a bother. Being yelled at for crying, I'm not supposed to feel bad. Something's wrong with me. I must hide it from them. When a child expresses a feeling and is told to just stop it and that it's wrong to feel that way, he thinks he is bad for having feelings and learns to repress them. Or she's told she should feel a different way. What's wrong with me that I don't have the right feeling? When a young child is bullied and tells a parent, and the parent offers no comfort, reassurance, or instruction, it must be okay for people to bully me. We are forming our beliefs about ourselves in the world, although we're not aware of it. Who am I? Do I belong? Do I matter? Is it safe? Can I trust anyone? Is there enough to go around? Who gets what? Will anyone help me? Am I lovable, worthy, adequate? When I went to the codependency treatment, I was told to raise my hand and say, I'm hurting, I need to share. I never would have come up with that solution. It was firmly ingrained in me not to show feelings or ask for anything that wasn't material and easily given. I was not even aware that I had that, quote, rule inside of me or that there were alternatives. When I attended an AA retreat led by a Catholic priest, he said, the big question is, do you feel welcome in the world or not? That took zero pondering on my part. Absolutely not. Children from healthy families know they are loved, wanted, accepted for who they are without question. Without discounting the role that genetics play in personality, which may be considerable, no one is born a narcissist or feeling less than, as far as I know. A newborn baby is almost always perceived as a precious new life. When did we stop being precious? Something happened to us. We did not at some point become defective or not enough. We came to believe we were defective or not enough. I knew this for sure by the time I was 5. The wonderful news here is that since this learned, we can change it. People are generally aware of overt abuse, but may be completely unaware they were emotionally or spiritually abused or neglected. That was me at my husband's family week, completely clueless about the reality of my family. The reason we aren't aware is because as children, we don't have anything to compare it to. Until I read The Emotionally Absent Mother, I had no idea what I'd been missing out on. I only had the mother I had, and I didn't know what other mothers offered more. I thought mom and dad were fine, and I was bad. When the same person teaches you to brush your teeth, look before crossing the street, there's no excuse for you. Pick your clothes up, don't cry, don't get angry, do your homework, shame on you, don't tease your sister, pick up your toys, etc. It all gets kind of jumbled together, and a lot of it appears sensible. We have no way to sort out what's true or healthy and what's not. Here's a trivial example. One time when I was a kid, I heard my mother comment that she would not want to live in a house on a corner because you have that side yard you have to take care of, but you can't really use it for anything. Fast forward to looking at houses for myself with a realtor, and she points out the one I end up buying, saying, this one's on a corner, so that's a plus. Because I had some recovery, instead of thinking to myself, I better find a new realtor, I asked, how is that a plus? She said, well, because you don't have a neighbor on one side. I was still going by what my mother taught me without ever re-examining it until then. There will be a lot of re-examining to do as our unconscious rules pop up during recovery. So Jill, alcoholic, what struck me on this reading was the rules. And I've always been a big rule person. I love rules. I knew exactly what was expected of me, where the line was, what I was supposed to do, when I was supposed to do it. It was great. So when I read this, I thought, I don't really think that's right. do I have any of those? And I thought about the unconscious part of it. And I thought, well, yeah, I do have that. Never, never take the last piece of cake. Don't do it. That's a rule. Can't take it. In the parking lot of the grocery store, never park on the line. You always have to be in the middle. So there's all these little tiny rules, but one that was unconscious that's kind of big was never ask for help. And there's always a right answer. A little background, I grew up in a very patriarchal home. And my dad is a narcissist and my mom was a codependent. So he thought he was God and my mom agreed. So there's four kids and that's all we knew. He was God. Whatever he said, that was right. That's the way it goes. That's the right answer. So I spent most of my life looking for that right answer. But it's very, very hard to live up to a set of rules that you didn't have anything to do with setting up and you eventually don't agree with. One of the things that I'd like to talk about is that my coming into secular AA, when I went almost 10 years ago to AA, it saved my life. I went into a room and everybody was really, really honest and it shocked me. And I couldn't believe that there were no putting on airs and everybody was just themselves and they all had problems and they all just talked about it. And then they laughed about it afterward. And that to me was magic. It was unbelievable. I was so willing to do anything that it took that I tried my hardest to believe in God. I tried everything I knew how to do. I read every single book I could think. I tried to read the Bible, but that was just, you know, like watching a horror film. So I didn't like that. And I quit. I started to do some internal work and look at some, you know, affirmations and doing all the, you know, what my sister calls the frou-frou work. And I realized that I was gaining resentment after resentment after resentment just from going to AA. So going to traditional AA made me quit AA. And then I decided I can't go anymore because it, you know, I feel bad about me. I feel like a damn liar. I've turned into a liar again, just like where I was 9 years ago. So I, on a whim, decided to go to the one meeting. I live in Jacksonville, Florida, which is the largest city in all of the United States, land-wise. And there's one meeting. And I went to that meeting and fell back in love with AA because everybody in there was honest. And they didn't care if I believed in God or didn't believe in God, anything. They truly believed that what's stamped on the back of the coin, to thine own self be true, they live it. I got to take a breath. Just thank you. I guess what I'm trying to say is that what secular AA did for me, as far as my program, this book did for me with regards to like an egomaniac and defective. This book has brought a new self-worth because all of a sudden there's a room full of people that feel like I do. And while there's no right answer, there's no right way to be, there's no wrong way to be, there's just differences. I've now found a fellowship of like-minded people. And the thing that we're all trying to do is just be happy in recovery. And there's just a ton of different ways to do that. So that's all. Thanks.
So Kent from Sydney, a few Australian accents here today. Would you care to do a reading, please?
Yeah. Hi, everybody. Kent, alcoholic. I'm just going to be reading the first page and a bit of chapter 6. It's called Feelings. The big book does not talk much about feelings, except for fear and anger. It tells us to ask God to remove these feelings. People like to point out there's no chapter called Into the Feeling, or they say things aren't facts and dismiss them. It is a fact that our feelings influence our thoughts and behavior, consciously or unconsciously. Ignoring them does not make them go away, nor does it stop them from seeking an outlet. Feelings are like children. We don't have to let them drive the car, but we cannot just keep locking them in the trunk. That's the very definition of emotional baggage. In my opinion, AA short circuits the emotional healing process. God save me from being angry is asking God to help me repress my feelings. Why not? God help me. Why not? God help me work through this feeling. Because they don't really go away until we work through them. It has been said that alcoholics are emotionally immature. That was true for me. I was taught not to listen to anything below the neck. We were learning the whole time, just like other kids, but we were learning different things, how to hide our feelings, how to be manipulative when we couldn't ask directly, how to be passive-aggressive when anger wasn't tolerated, and how to keep people away from us with sarcasm or an unfriendly demeanor so they wouldn't see our broken insides or because we were afraid. So we are delayed in more functional ways to handle emotions. For more information on emotions, I recommend Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Coleman and the previously mentioned Gibson book, Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents. Having feelings is a normal part of being human. We have them because they serve the evolutionary purpose of survival. They aren't good or bad, they just are. Feelings give us information about ourselves, information I was taught to ignore for so long, I was barely aware of it. Fight, anger, or flight, fear, are basic responses to a perceived threat to keep us safe. Anger gives us immediate power and strength to defend ourselves. Fear, flight says, run away, you can't win. Feeling pain, hurt, or sadness tells us what is important. If we didn't care, it wouldn't hurt. It also brings healing and connection with others, as it is part of the human condition. Guilt tells us we have done something wrong, which may be fixable. Joy, happiness, and other positive emotions are good for our health and make life worth living. Loneliness signifies our need for connection. We evolved in social groups, not as loners. Loners didn't survive. Emotions are part of the long history of human evolution, and we are not allowing ourselves the full extent of our humanity when we refuse to acknowledge them. Healthy shame tells us we're not God. We can't just do whatever we want all the time. Its evolutionary process is to inhibit or hide any behavior that might get us kicked out of our social group, since our survival depends on being in the group. A person should have enough shame to keep them from going to the grocery shopping naked. Don't go to the grocery store naked. I don't think I read those paragraphs particularly well. So, but they're definitely worth reading. And I'm reading from the Amazon digital version. I've been in AA for a bit over a year now, 14 or so months. About 10 years ago, I was in for about 3 months, and I only went to God-based AA then. And actually, I left after trying to do step four with my sponsor. Curiously, I think I didn't think about it at the time, but the more time I spend in groups, the agnostic groups, and from reading Best Book and doing this group, I'm starting to realize that perhaps it was confronting that my parents weren't perfect, as we just heard in Jill's chapter from Best Book, that I couldn't deal with it. I thought my parents were perfect and, not bad people. We're not so naive to think they weren't perfect. And I just think I couldn't deal with it. And I just got out and went back to drinking. Part of my drinking is clearly been about not dealing with my feelings and not being honest to myself about what's been going on in my life. So coming to a group like this, it helps me uncover these things. things that I knew were lurking in the background that I just couldn't find a way to uncover. And the amazement to me is the twofold thing of just the business of coming to the fellowship of AA, and in particular AA that doesn't try to tell me that you know, the light bulb in the sky or something's going to miraculously solve problems, because I've never had a problem miraculously solved, I don't think. But application of some logic and some persistence in the right direction does get results. And also I think the knowing that the result came from listening to other people, getting help from other people, from reading information that can guide me in the right direction. You know, I'm really happy with the way my life's going now, and I'm really happy with not drinking, getting up in the morning and feeling good. And you know, this is not directly relevant, but, you know, I went to a 60th birthday party a couple of nights ago. It was the first birthday party type thing with friends that I've known for a long, long time. Nobody even asked me whether I was drinking or not. You know, I had a cordial or something, and I danced. And I think it's probably the first time because it was a Studio 54 party. And, you know, I danced on the dance floor sober. I'm not sure if I've ever done that before in my life. I'm really not sure if I've ever done that before in my life. And I felt great. My partner and I left early. She's not in the program. She had a couple of drinks. We left early. We got home. The next morning I woke up, I remembered everything, and I thought, wow, that was really fun. It never occurred to me in my life that I could do that. Go to a party, stay sober, remember what happened, everything, or, you know, well, I don't remember absolutely everything, but, you know, most of it. This group in particular and this book's helped me understand aspects of myself that I wasn't really getting into. And actually just listening to the reading Jill did, I thought, yeah, there's stuff in there that helps me understand my family, my background, why I am the way I am, and how I can live better, a better life, being the person that I am, not the person I'm trying to ignore or some other person I'm trying to become that's not me. I'll just leave it there. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks very much, Kent. And you're up next.
Hey, everybody. It's an addict to everything that gives me warmth and comfort. So I'm going to read a little excerpt off of step zero. There's actually a step zero in this book. And this one was one of the ones that hit me the hardest. It says, we improved our self-esteem and attitude enough to begin working the 12 steps. Negative self-talk. I was pretty beat down when I arrived in AA. Being an alcoholic was just one more nail in the coffin of being a defective loser. Working the steps to me looked like submitting myself to the beating I deserved for being an alcoholic. I didn't see anything positive about it. In hindsight, I wish that someone had told me, let's work on your self-esteem first to get it up to the point where you can contemplate taking a look at yourself without it feeling like a punishment and possibly even see it as an opportunity. Nearly every thought or feeling I had about myself was negative. Assuming you feel the same way, we have to get up to sea level before we can start climbing the steps. For me, this included antidepressants too. We are going to work the steps to stay sober and improve our self-esteem. We are creating something, a healthier, happier person, and a more fulfilling life. It is not a punishment. It's a tremendous opportunity. Our self-talk is such a habit, we don't even notice it, or we don't think it's negative. We think it's deserved, or it's the only way we know how to motivate ourselves, because we will be so terrible if we don't do this. If building self-esteem is like knitting a sweater, the negative self-talk is the yarn we pull on to unravel the whole thing. It is counterproductive, to say the least, to be stitching something together with one hand and pulling it apart with the other. Give me a different analogy. We're trying to build our secure home base within us. We can't build up our insides to fill a home with ourselves while the termites of self-criticism keep eating it away. It is nearly impossible to completely rid ourselves of self-criticism because we have been doing it forever. It's almost like deciding to change your dominant hand. You could probably do it, but it would take a lot of time, attention, and conscious effort. No one can maintain that degree of conscious effort all the time. We would expect on many occasions to use the old hand and not even notice. With practice, we might catch ourselves sometimes, oops, used the wrong hand. Think of this the same way. It is that hand going on autopilot, doing it the old way will happen a lot. We will not beat ourselves up over that. It's completely expected. It's how brain wiring works.
I wish I found this group in my early sobriety. It took me almost 18 months to even get step four completed. It was a huge struggle for me, huge struggle, because I just, I didn't want to know was my biggest thing. I didn't want to know. I didn't want to know what kind of parents I actually had. That's what I'm going to say. I didn't want to know what kind of parents I had. And the God word was a big one for me too. The God word was a big one. Every time I heard the God word, I would grind my teeth. It was so bad. Eventually, I ended up with a spiritual advisor who was very secular, opposed to my first sponsor, who was very traditional, which was like when I was able to say the God word in our serenity prayer, she was like almost jumping with joy. Meanwhile, the God word to me at that point, just to make them happy for me, it meant the great outdoors, right? So I was able to bypass it because of the great outdoors. But if I would have built my self-esteem before I did the steps, it probably wouldn't have taken me so darn long to accomplish. Because I just barely finished my fourth step, like I think about a month ago. So it took me damn near 18 months to do that. I know this book where it tells about the shame, but then I had read about the reverse pride and I'm like, what the fuck? What's reverse pride, right? And I'm like, and then I read about it and I'm like, but it says I'm entitled. I don't think I'm entitled at all. On the contrary, I think everything's my goddamn fault. And, you know, my world revolves around whoever's around me, right? Boundaries is another one I'm learning. Been a freaking long journey to build myself back up from where I was. Like, low self-esteem is definitely something that I've been struggling with for a very, very, very long time. And I'm so happy I was able to find this group, which I found you guys like, what, a week ago? I think it was about a week ago, and we were just finishing the book at that time. So best time to find you because I get to start all over again. And with that, guys, thank you.
Thank you, Tan. Stephanie, you're up next. Would you like to do your read, please?
Yeah, sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Stephanie, Personal Recovery. It's good to see you all. All right. So my stuff is from step one. So it talks a little bit about self-esteem. So low self-esteem made our lives unmanageable long before we started drinking. Denying our true selves in order to survive has forced us to focus on how we're supposed to act, how we're supposed to feel, and what we're supposed to think in order to appease and placate the big people. In other words, the way we actually are is wrong or bad. This is the message we internalized, and we learned how to be what other people want us to be. In a healthy family, we'd be learning about ourselves, our own feelings and how to manage them, our own desires and how to fulfill some of them, our own thoughts and how to make sense of them. Living in a grown-up world without grown-up skills is unmanageable. Being out of touch with our true selves is a hollow feeling, right inside there where the quote, me is supposed to be. There's nothing but an abandoned child and no one remembers her name anymore. We are so filled with angst that it's like air to us. We don't even notice it. But all the same, it produces stress hormones, interferes with our immune systems, makes us feel restless, irritable, and discontent. Alcohol seemed to be the magic potion that took all this away. But now that alcohol is not an option, we realize the true solution is to do this work so that we can be comfortable in our own skin. Many of us arrive in AA looking pretty good on the outside, but because that was our priority, but we are a mess on the inside. We knew we really didn't deserve the validation we got from others. We felt like imposters. We compartmentalized our lives and our thoughts to avoid cognitive dissonance. Unmanageability was internal. At this point, we have admitted to being powerless over alcohol and others. These are both empirical facts. We can't control our drinking and we can't control others. We have likely proven these to ourselves numerous times. But then let's look at the power we do have. We have a lot of power that we have been not using because we've been too afraid to stand up for ourselves or didn't know that was allowed or possible. A lot of us have lived our lives seeking validation and approval from others, effectively giving them the power to determine how we feel about ourselves. We have the power to define ourselves and not be defined by others. We have the power to claim our worth and not let others determine it for us. We have the power to not take responsibility or blame for things out of our control or for someone else's bad behavior. We have the power to say no when we don't want to do something. We have the power to make our own decisions and accept the consequences. We have the power to define our roles in life according to our own standards. We have the power to let our voice be heard along with everyone else's, and we have the power to walk away from bad situations. So for me, I think the biggest thing that stands out for me is I feel like I didn't have a voice. When I came in, it just seemed like such a far away thing that I could actually stand up for myself. I think for a long time, I didn't know who I was. And I think, like it says, you know, being out of touch with ourselves is such a hollow feeling. I feel like that's what I was when I came into AA just over 13 months ago. Alcohol was the potion that took everything away from me. It was the most amazing thing that I could run to. And, you know, I wouldn't remember anything afterwards. But the thing is, I know that I have to put the alcohol away and that it's been time like this for 13 months where I have taken it away from my life. And I'm somehow feel like that is the only solution is to get comfortable in my own skin. I'm finally starting to get to that point where I am getting comfortable in who I am because I thought for such a long time I needed a substance to make things better for me, to calm me down. But in reality, it was just an easy solution that now I don't think about it. I don't think about drinking. I was a mess on the inside, especially as I've come into this program, I realized how much of a mess my head was. And it's still kind of growing up and learning how to be on its own. I think I couldn't make sense of the world when I first came in. It was just everything was chaotic inside my mind. It was like something was running around constantly. But now I sit here and say that I'm pretty comfortable in my own skin. I've learned how to be myself, stand up for myself because it wasn't possible for me. And I did seek, I also am in another fellowship, but, you know, I do seek validation and approval from others. And I'm trying to learn to not do that and seek it for myself. You know, I kind of am learning to like who I am, you know, saying good qualities about my personality, and even some days I don't feel like it and I feel like crap, but I know that I'm worth something, and that's really, really news to know that I'm actually worth something, and it comes from me, and it's not about trying to please all of you in this amazing room, but it's about making myself happy and doing what makes me feel better and avoiding the cognitive dissonance, because that if I just go back into that mental state, I know that that's a really bad state for me to get in. And learning that I'm not an imposter. I'm Stephanie. I'm a person in recovery. So it's good to be here. Thank you all.
Thank you, Stephanie. Phil, would you like to do your reading, please?
Good evening. Good morning. My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to be reading Chapter 9, Step 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. In step one, we admitted that our willpower, although it may be great in some areas, failed at getting and keeping us sober. To the alcoholic, alcohol is not cunning, baffling, or powerful. To us, it is because of our complicated relationship with it. It's that siren's call in our heads, speaking to us in our own voice, sounding perfectly reasonable to the unsuspecting. Every time I failed to make it as many days as I had planned without drinking, I just told myself I'd changed my mind. In reality, that was a rationalization after the fact. I gave in to the craving and tried to explain it away afterward, and I believed my explanation. This is one of the reasons I still go to meetings. Other people can easily see through my BS, but I frequently can't. If you believe that your only help will come from a higher power that is loosely defined as an all-powerful, in charge, loves you, and has a plan for your life, go with the big book. For me, I just needed help, and it came from many sources, the most important one being AA. There are many things I can't do by myself, like move a piano or fix my car, but I can get someone to help me go to a place where someone has the necessary skills. I can consult a sponsor or put myself in the presence of people who are staying sober. For us, restoration to sanity has two parts. First, there is the insanity of active alcoholism and all the thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that go along with it. During that part of our lives, we may actually have been like the alcoholic personality described in the book, selfish, self-centered, and stepping on toes. The need to drink overpowered our normally polite behavior. The big book covers this part of alcoholism. But were we really sane before we started drinking? Recall that knowing we are adequate and worthy is fundamental to sane living. Restore is really not the right word here if we have no memory of ever feeling good about ourselves. We have to learn it from scratch. I have a baby picture of myself smiling like, "Hello, world. I'm here and I feel good about it." I have no memory of it, but I've been working on restoring myself to that. I accept it as fact that I am intrinsically good, not perfect or infallible, and all this recovery work can allow that little light to shine again. Most days it does, so I have faith that it works. I have seen it happen to other alcoholics, so I have hope and faith in the process. Recovery work is learning how to feel and express my feelings, changing my perceptions of myself and others, letting go of self-limiting beliefs, trying new behaviors, allowing or forcing myself to take risks and be vulnerable, clearing away the wreckage of the past, and more. I cannot do these things by myself. How can you fix relationship problems without being in relationships? How can you begin to feel like you fit in without being around others? When I first read the 12 steps, I looked at them as an academic exercise because I was unaware of the other parts of being a person. I wanted to rush through them as an achievement and get a year in 6 months. Turns out, they involve growing up emotionally and spiritually. It takes a year's growth to get a year. It takes being emotional and practicing the principles one day at a time. Left to its own devices, my brain on autopilot repeats what I learned in childhood. I needed new input. There was nothing wrong with the way my brain worked, but as the saying goes, garbage in, garbage out. When a sow's ear goes in, a silk purse doesn't come out. I knew how to be responsible and self-sufficient, but I didn't know who I was or how to be emotional, social, and interdependent. AA meetings and AA people are a great way to try out new behavior, check whether a long-held assumption is actually true, see if people are really thinking what you think they're thinking. AA people mirrored myself back to me more accurately than my family did because they didn't have their own agendas with me. Find a group that will love you and until you learn to love yourself. Learning to trust others and be vulnerable requires a safe environment. You will find that in meetings, hopefully. Keep trying different meetings until you find the one that feels right for you. I've also read tons of recovery and self-help books, got medical help for depression, and worked with therapists, family of origin, and trauma issues. Don't be afraid to seek help in any area you may need it. These areas are outside of issues as far as AA goes, but they can absolutely affect the quality of your sobriety. The lesson of step two for me is I need help. It's available and it works. I started out in traditional AA, And I made it 11 months and 2 weeks, I think, until my first relapse. I came to realize that a lot of it was because I had no ability to accept this idea of a higher power. I didn't really, even though I was raised Catholic, went to Catholic grade school, high school, college, took all the morality and the ethics classes and things like that, eventually realized that, you know, I don't believe in any of that crap. So this idea that some higher power was going to help me, help relieve me of my obsession with alcohol, just didn't work for me. And I relapsed for a good period of time, and my drinking just took a drastic downturn to blacking out every single night of the week. Still getting up the next day to go to work and feeling really bad about it. And then I found secular AA. And I found some meetings where I could actually get the help I needed. And that turned the corner for me. And along the way, you know, I've developed some ideas in the past 29 months of sobriety. And, you know, it's my opinion that, you know, it takes a bit of faith that if we're going to continue on this journey of seeking help, of learning more about ourselves, that our lives will get better. You know, it takes a little bit of faith. It takes a little bit of faith in, you know, the rationality of the 12-step program to help with recovery. You know, even though I'm not a person who has formally worked all of these steps, I do believe that they're helpful for a great many people, and that that there's really no wrong way to get sober. There is also no right way to pick up that first drink. So this idea that of faith, I know that there's going to be good days and I'm going to have bad days. But I still have to have that faith that things are going to get better if I keep working at it, if I keep coming to AA meetings. And as I travel this path to spiritual growth, I'm beginning to develop the ability to draw on spiritual resources that are all around me, you know, in nature, in living simply, in music, and in my relationships with other AA members. And what I found was that I needed to find the meetings that fit my needs and help me to get to the place where, you know, I could honestly and truly accept that I was an alcoholic and that that was okay. And finding this meeting, I suffer from some, you know, self-esteem issues in the sense that I'm just super hyperly critical of myself all the time. And nothing that I do, you know, for myself is ever good enough. And that's kind of difficult, along with being severely introverted. You know, sitting here and talking to everyone is a little bit difficult, but I'm learning to work through that. And, you know, I've found that there's sources of spiritual power that exist both outside of us and within us. And, you know, this second step, even though I'm not don't really believe in a higher power, this second step is leading me to believe that I have the power to change. I just need a little help. And this group is helping me with esteem issues, with my introversion, and, you know, putting that second step into action and having the faith that things are going to get better. Thanks.
Thanks, Bill. Tracy, please.
Thank you, PJ. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I'm Tracy, person in recovery. I was hoping Bill would talk a little longer, but that's okay. Okay. My reading is from step 3 in the book. And I'll pull that up here. And I've had it open. Embarrassing. Here we go. Okay. I'm going to start from the top of this paragraph. I had highlighted a part lower down, but I'm going to start at the beginning of the paragraph. Don't these stand in the way of our enjoying life, having healthy relationships, and being useful to others in a non-codependent way? For example, when we judge ourselves so harshly, we frequently start to judge others too. When we accept more than our fair share of the blame for something, don't we invite becoming a dumping ground for others who accept too little responsibility? When we doubt our own feelings, thoughts, and perceptions, we will accept someone else's reality as our own, even though it doesn't fit. When we are too inhibited to try something new, we remain stuck in our comfort zone, which somehow keeps getting smaller. When we are too centered about what others may think, we're not focused on what we think and what's right for us. We are self-centered like Bill, but not just like Bill. We're not trying to dominate those around us, stepping on other people's toes and not noticing the damage to them. We are trying to protect ourselves from getting hurt. Our coping behaviors damage us more than others. To be in recovery means to stand up in the light of day and to be counted as a worthy human being, just like everyone else. Whether you ask God to relieve you of all this bondage or work on it with your sponsor and recovery community or both, it's up to you. I've been in this fellowship since 91, and I've been sober since 91. I started off in traditional, as I like to call it, Orthodox AA. And I believed in there was an invisible man in the sky who was in control of everything. And all I had to do was ask him for what I needed. And much like Santa Claus, he would just kind of give me whatever I wanted, you know, and he would relieve these issues I'm having with this drugs and alcohol. And so I did, you know, I ended up going to AA. What ended up taking me to the program was an intervention. And my whole life, I felt like I just wasn't comfortable in my own skin. And when I say that, I mean my own skin as a human being and also my own skin as a Black male. Okay. And just being a human being was hard enough, but then I'm a Black man as well. I don't know if anybody's noticed that, but I'm a Black guy. Those two things layered on top of each other, it was just a double whammy for me. And I was always just painfully shy, just a horrible, it was to the flop sweat shy. I just couldn't speak. I couldn't talk. I later learned that these are mental health issues that I had, you know what I mean? So moving forward, you know, I eventually found alcohol and drugs and, you know, through people, places and things and friends, and it relieved all of that. I finally felt comfortable, you know, I could breathe, you know, you know, I'm like, this is great, you know? So I did it, and the progression of the disease happened just like it happened to, I'm guessing, almost everybody in this whole conference. And it worked until it didn't, you know, plain and simple. And when it stopped working, I was confused. So I'm like, I better try harder, you know, because I don't want to go back to that discomfort, you know. But now I have the discomfort and the alcoholism, you know. Holy shit. So my family ended up taking me to treatment, and I started the process of AA, and I prayed again. I prayed and I went to the meetings and I did the steps and I listened to the guys yelling at me and telling me to sit down and shut up. And, you know, my first sponsor would poke me in the chest and tell me, you don't know nothing. And, you know, inside I felt like, well, he's right. You know, I don't know anything. Finally somebody sees it. You know, I already knew it, you know. And then they talked about the ego deflation and all that. And I'm like, oh, the ego deflation. Okay. Okay, you know, I just listened. I didn't know what I didn't know. So I went and I did what they said, and I did get sober. I did a half-assed job of AA and I did get sober, you know, and that's a testament to the program. I'm going to say that. A lot of it was that, and that a lot of it was just I stayed away from it long enough to, you know, to get the drugs and alcohol out of my system. And I did just enough of a half-ass job to get everybody off my back. And I would say whatever you wanted to hear me say and do whatever you told me to do. And you would stop yelling at me and I could feel comfortable and I could crawl back into my little hole, you know, and that's what I did. So I still felt uncomfortable in my skin. I still felt anxiety. I was anxiety riddled. Couldn't talk, couldn't stand up in front of two or three people and say anything, you know, and I'm an artist, by the way. So here I'm pouring my heart out into these drawings and art, and I'm supposed to present it to people, you know, what do you think of this? And some people loved it. If 100 people loved it and showered me with praise and one person was like, meh, I was crushed. I was just crushed. And I took it so hard, you know. So that was me in a nutshell. And so I'm in AA and I'm doing all the things again, just go along to get along. That's what I do. And that was how I lived my life drinking. And that's how I was living my life sober, you know, still feeling uncomfortable and anxious and still feeling outside, like I was on the outside looking in. And somebody said earlier today, distrust of the human experience. Been a lot of great meetings today. And I learned that, you know, that was so true for me. I just had a distrust of the human experience. Just moving ahead a bit. So I stopped going to meetings because I got tired of AA as I was getting tired of when I was drinking, and I'm like, I don't know what to do here. So I just stopped going, and I took with me, don't pick up the first drink and you won't get drunk. And I went out, you know, and I just said, I'm done with that. I'm not doing that anymore. And I started to search and I started to read and I started to find, you know, other self-help books. And I started to think, oh, maybe the Bible has something to say. I never read this Bible and I was scared of it. You know, just by, ooh. So I read the Bible, started to read the Bible. And I'm like, what the hell is this shit? You know, there's like snakes talking, and there's just, the Bible is pretty. And look, if that's your thing, okay. But for me, I'm like, this thing is crazy. There's like rape and incest. And I'm like, this is what everybody's, you know? So, I mean, that began my backing away from any type of religion or anything like that. So I found some great counselors that helped me out through the years. And I started to unpack all of that stuff, you know, all this stuff that people have been telling me that I should believe, because I had a lot of that kind of trauma, if you will, from religion and parents and that. I started to back away from any type of religious belief. And I realized that I only believed it because somebody told me I should believe it. You know, low self-esteem, horrible, you know, and I didn't think it was okay for me to just think that. I thought somebody had to tell me. So I get to a good, great counselor. I found a great secular counselor, and I'm going to meetings, I have a friend who says, Tracy, how long we've both been sober? We've both been sober about the same time. And we hadn't been going to meetings because we'd just been kind of disillusioned by the whole thing. And he says, maybe we should go back and help some new guys. You know, we've been sober a long time. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, that's not a bad idea. It had been enough time. I thought maybe I'll go back and some of this changed, you know? And so I did. And it was the same shit. I'm like, oh, I just had this churning in my stomach when they would say, okay, can we pray for anybody sick and in the hospital at the meeting? And I'd be like, oh, you know, just didn't fit. Wasn't me. So I looked around for some agnostic meetings and I found one agnostic meeting in Cleveland, Ohio. And it was way across town and I didn't care. I went to it. I just went to it every week, you know. And that began my deconversion from, you know, Orthodox AA. And so everybody knows pandemic story, blah, 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 and looking around for stuff. And I finally got a good counselor, but I still have this thing, you know, this low self-esteem, this, I'm still hearing the same stuff in agnostic meetings, you know, the ego and all of that. And, you know, you're, and I'm like, oh, you know, I still have that grinding. And a friend of mine, my recovery partner here, Stephanie, says she would just find these meetings, which is pretty cool. She was just all over finding meetings. And she found this PJ guy has this meeting. And I'm like, oh, that book about the egomaniacs. Like, I was scared to read it. Like, why I was scared to read that. That tells you anything. But you know what? I did start reading it. I'm like, this is awesome. And we came to the meeting. And I'm like, this is like, I felt like I could just sleep there. You know, this, it's so comfortable a meeting for me, you know, and I've been at it ever since. I make sure I come to it. I might have missed it once and I was mad because the time changed. I was pissed. But so yeah, we went through the book and when we decided to do this for the conference, I'm like, what do I pick? I could just throw a dart and just, you know, could be anything. I just identify with all of it so much, you know, and I can't wait for us to start it again. And I'm helping out with the conference here. And I said in the early planning, we've been meeting every Sunday for this conference for a while now, at least about 4 or 5 months. I have been anyway. And I said, I'm going to be in the we're not all egomaniacs meeting. And I'm going to be, you know, the bouncer in there and record it. Like, and I didn't care about the rest of the meetings all day or tomorrow, today. Don't care. Like, I got to be in that meeting, you know. And I got to be with my tribe. And so anyway, that's my spiel. And I really think it's a great meeting. And I'd really thank PJ and Beth for writing a book, and PJ for your service and starting a meeting. And let's keep trudging the road. Thank you.
Thanks, Tracy. Tracy, we can keep going, can we? We're not going to get shut down at 7:30.
No, you're fine.
Well, if that's okay with people, I'm the only one who hasn't read a section. And if you want to hang around, the other meeting is about to begin. But if you want to hang around and have questions after, you know, there's no, like the pub isn't closing, still going on. So I chose a reading from section on feelings, and that line, you know, I heard this in Sydney, you know, emotions and feelings are not facts, you know, I just didn't want to hear this. And I was at a meeting one night and this guy gets up and says, emotions and feelings are not facts, right? And the next I get up and says, well, I feel depressed, and that's a fact. So that was the end of that. So I've selected from page 76, and there's a good reason why I've selected this one. Everyone carries around with them in their mind some sort of working model below their conscious awareness about how the world functions, who I am, what are people like, am I safe? Do I belong, etc. When something doesn't match our model, we adjust the model to match reality. If we mature in a healthy fashion, the model becomes less black and white, more complex, more nuanced. But if we feel threatened as children, we develop defense mechanisms, variations of fight, flight, freeze, and appease. They help us not to get hurt, but they also prevented us from maturing. Instead of having an open, exploring attitude towards new experiences, our focus was on staying safe. Most people broaden their horizons as they grow up. Their world gets bigger. They see new things that don't fit previous conceptions and grow into broader perspectives. But we have been shut down, full of defense mechanisms, living in fear, whether we were aware of it or not. When we did that, we shut the door on our emotional growth. We were on lockdown. We are still living with the model we acquired at a very young age. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. When our working model doesn't grow and change to better fit the current reality, we suffer. It's almost like we're still trying to master checkers, while everyone else has moved on to playing chess. Most educated people understand the difference between anecdotal evidence and actual data. The new medication is tried out on many people before it gets FDA approval. They can't give it to one or two people who have no side effects and then claim it's safe for everyone. It's the same with us and our worldview and conditioned response. I assume everyone out there is dangerous. They want to see me make a fool of myself, tell me I'm fat or don't want me around. Based on my own anecdotal experience of growing up in my particular family, the rest of the world is not thinking any of those things or even thinking about me at all. That's me viewing the world through my past experience. It doesn't match reality. To mature emotionally means to open up little by little and recognize that we have extrapolated way too broadly based on our unique anecdotal evidence. Open-mindedness is essential to recovery. I just really appreciate this book because the way that it's structured, and each week we read through it, and it just basically unfolds and gives me this way of dealing with different facets of my sobriety. This brought back so many memories. So I've seen about 6 psychologists in over 25 years. And it was the last one that I saw that nailed down that a lot of my problems stem from my Irish Catholic upbringing. Now, my home situation, I felt very safe. Like my story is quite different to Beth's in that now they weren't perfect parents. Being at home was always safe. So I just couldn't identify with that part. But what I could, there was another sort of a parent in the room, and that was the Catholic Church. So I'm from, you know, an Irish Catholic, I should say industrial strength, Irish Catholic background. And then you go to school, and I, for those of you old enough, was corporal punishment. And I got beaten as a kindie, and I mean beaten. And, you know, a teacher had this big stick, and another one had a ruler, and she'd use the edge of it and put your hand out. Like in front of the class, you'd be humiliated. So I learned, do not give a wrong answer. Don't make a mistake. Sit as you're told. So I worked through with a psychologist with this. And basically my framework was, I want to feel safe and secure all the time. I cannot step outside that. But if I do, you know, mistakes are bad. They're a sin. You get punished. But the problem with that, and I virtually lived it completely, is that if you basically just only tackle tasks that are safe and have a very low risk, and you avoid situations where you might make it safe. But the problem with that is that you get depressed because you get bored. And even if you're doing something that you're safe at, you're going, well, what if they ask me to do something I don't know? So it never actually gets you anywhere. And what this psychologist taught me is that, you know, I had to let go, you know, of this idea. And I had to front up and start trying things. Like today, I made the mistake that was 7 minutes past the time. And inside me, there's this initial sticks coming out. Like, that's there. But then I'm going, yeah. It's like this other, when you bugger off, like inside my head, I'm going, listen, just could get lost, right? Like, I've got this companion inside, you know, my head, and I had to say, look, just go away. And I went, is it a big deal? And then I thought, well, I can just share at the end and see if it's time. And everything worked out. And who else really minds anyway? So that was sort of the framework. When I picked up a drink at 19, I never matured from then on. So for 14 years, my cohort would be learning things. You get a few knocks in life and you basically mature. So, you know, apart from the fact that I'm an alcoholic, I was immature. So I came in here at 33 as a very immature 19-year-old. And I had to start to mature. So it's really about growing up. And one of the other things that this has taught me is I've learned new terminology. So everyone that comes to a meeting will know 2 weeks ago I did a dump because I had this massive resentment against my boss, and it was an overreaction for what it was. And people listened to me, which was great, and then they offer their feedback, and I'm going, ah. So, you know, what this event triggered was a shame event from my past. Because what happens, you know, I get paralyzed. I become the little kid again. I'm back in the classroom, and the teacher has the big stick, and she calls me out the front. And it's terrifying. But from walking through this book, few people. I've had a few wins as well. And I, you know, at least I know what it is. And I'm not bad. And, you know, and also I didn't respond in the situation because one of the thoughts went through my head was a baseball bat response, which wouldn't do any good. And I thought, even though I felt bad afterwards, he didn't know what was going on inside me. I just looked at him, and then I could deal with it afterwards. So that's me done. And now the floor, I think, we're here for as long as you want, is open. And anybody who hasn't got to say anything so far, if you would like to make a comment or talk, please put your hand up literally or virtually. Roddy, is that how I pronounce your name?
Hi, Roddy. Rady, that's all right. That was so sweet that I happened to drop into this meeting right when Tracy is talking because I know him. So, and I got more out of your lead this time than when you spoke for me at Beggars, Tramps, and Queers. More insight into you. Thank you. But I just wanted to share, if I'm allowed, this weekend conference has been so fantastic for me. Oh my God, I feel like what a blessing it is to be around a bunch of rational, intelligent, thoughtful people about spiritual principles, which is how, you know, my spirit about, I don't mean anything religious by that, but it's just such a relief. And we started a group, by the way, in April, online meeting, and it's LGBTQIA, blah, blah, blah. And mostly young and mostly drug addicts. And most of them have less than 2 years of sobriety. And then there's like three or four old timers there who hang out. But it's such an experience to watch everything here. People in secular AA talk about their experience with AA, about the God word and how, what a problem it was for them and how they had to translate and all that. And yet this meeting we started, that these new people aren't experiencing that at all, but they are agnostic. It's so fun to watch them find out who they are without being shamed. Anyway, it's just these two events together are just wonderful for me, and I'm glad to be here. Thank you all for coming and putting it on and everything. I pass.
Thank you very much, Wendy. Anybody else? Yes, Anna, please.
Hi, everyone. this was great. And just for those of you who don't already know me, I'm in this group too, and I absolutely love it. And listening to you all, something really struck me tonight because I'm dealing with PTSD, and I was dealing with it while I was drinking. I mean, that was one of the, I was trying to medicate it partly. And I've had some more traumatic experiences since I quit drinking 20 months ago. And I realized recently a lot of what I'm feeling is shame. And I think I've just felt that so much throughout my life. I didn't even really know what it was. I mean, I kind of knew what it was, but boy, oh boy, it's hit me hard and often. And my counselor said, well, that is at the height of the emotional activation of PTSD, shame is really a big thing. And I was going, oh boy. And I looked at this chart, and sure enough, there it is right at the top of the, curve when things get really bad. So, and that's a lot of what we're addressing in this book. And this approach is so important for me because, I see a lot of narcissists in traditional AA, and they scare me, man. I'm afraid of them. Being in a group where we can address that and, have an alternative approach and validate each other's differentness. And I can talk about the fact that I'm feeling ashamed and afraid, and my path to recovery, doesn't follow the same road that a lot of other people's does, and people will know what I'm talking about. That's enough for me. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. I just trying to coax a few people. Trish on the Gold Coast was a regular. Would you care to say a few words, please?
Hi, PJ. Thank you hiding behind me. I'm just thoroughly enjoying. Thank you for asking me to share. And I'm Trish Alcoholic, and I want to thank PJ and Bess and everybody that's been part of this meeting, especially because I too started coming to PJ's meeting on a Monday, and then on the Friday, you know, this wonderful book that Beth has written, and it spoke to me immediately. I've been in AA sober for 41 years now, and at the beginning of this book, I want to, you know, say to Beth and to anyone, I'm just going to, if I can, I'll just the reading that spoke to me enormously so. I still get sort of emotional about the fact that I'm still here 41 years later, not out of ego, but the fact that I'm still alive. But this one, the dedication, because this book is dedicated to the unknown number of alcoholics with low self-esteem who either left Alcoholics Anonymous or stayed, even though it was painful and psychologically damaging because there was nowhere else to go. You are not alone, and I hope you will give it another try. I get very emotional with that because I'm still here. That's why I say I wanted to walk away. I didn't know what narcissism was. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I knew that that's, you know, I came to understand. I think the thing that, and it's not against Bill Wilson or Bob or anything like that, I'm very dedicated to AA. My heart is, it overflows, really, the fact that it was where I went to find sobriety, if you will. The actual tradition of that means a lot to me, a desire to stop drinking. But more importantly for me personally at the time, broken and beaten, low self-esteem, sitting on the floor, you know, 28-year-old with a 2-year-old to raise. And, you know, I had the desire, but more importantly, I had the desire to stay stopped. I no longer wanted to be living as I was living. And I've been granted that, you know. And I felt, I remember looking up in the step, you know, in meeting once, and I thought, I've been already doing these steps. After I went to, thankfully, I went to Al-Anon 6 months prior to going to AA. But I'd read in an article in the paper 6 months before I did get sober that that alcoholism was a family disease. I didn't know it was a disease of disease. I didn't know that it was a family thing. But I suspected growing up and all those things. But so I started to basically find self-esteem, so to speak. I went and sat in Al-Anon once a week, but I knew I was alcoholic. You know, my drinking did get less, but my self-esteem picked up, you know, not into ego, but it got off the floor, put it that way. But once it was 6 months down the track, and the famous saying for alcoholics, one won't hurt, and I was very smug, I suppose, I thought, maybe I'm not an alcoholic, you know, because my drinking just got less and even near nil, you know, in Al-Anon. This fellow said, come on, it's Christmas time, one won't hurt you. And it was Pernod, a drink I never drank, and it hit me like a ton of bricks, and it sent me on a, what do you call it, just a month-long bender, you know, back into where I'd already been and didn't want to be. And so that was what made me walk through. It nearly killed me. I nearly died on my last drink and nearly drowned. And you know, I was throwing up, and I'm sorry for going on about it, but throwing up and losing my bowels in amongst everyone over on the island. It was Australia Day, and, you know, there were families and all sorts of things. So that was my very last drink, and I really wanted to die that day. And but walking, I knew there was a place to go. Identified the first meeting 6 months prior. I walked in through the doors, and I've never left. But when Beth put that introduction, the dedication there, AA was a few, not AA, but the egomaniacs and narcissism damaged me terribly psychologically. And so it was my big fight was to, I suppose, I have a bit of a giggle, but I just think, you know, the in AA that were back in the system, so to speak, as well, and they wrote books and all that sort of thing, just like this book has been written, and it's just saved my life on many, many occasions, saved my daughter's life. And do I believe in God? I believe there's something. I believe there was something not so much greater than myself, but that brought me back to myself, put it that way. That I have two legs to stand on now and a brain and a mind that I didn't think was, you know, was possible. And I've studied and I've done all the things I didn't think were possible. I'm getting emotional because, I mean, who do you think? And I mean, Sam, there's so too many things, people and places in the world. To be, I'm just still here, and I do thank you, PGA, for being part of, you know, this lovely group in Sydney and throughout the world, and you know, being part of this today, it's quite a privilege to be part of it. So thanks for asking me to share. Thank you.
Thanks, Trish. It's always good to hear you. Somebody else has sent me a chat message. Christina H. with the 808 days. Would you like to say a few words at all? No, that's okay. Anybody else, just put your hand up. The floor is open.
So I'm Peggy. I am an alcoholic. And I was just fixing dinner and clicked on this meeting. I don't know what the book is. I can tell I could have used it, you know, 38 years ago. I just really appreciated everything I've heard and how, so what it said to me is how grateful I am that I don't have so many of those feelings that ruled my life anymore, you know, because I've worked and worked and worked and worked and worked with, you know, lots of outside help. But how much shame I came in with and how much shame or shaming I have received in traditional AA through the years. But, you know, it was all I knew, right? And so that's where I stayed. I mean, I've always, always been very clear that if I did not stay, I would drink again. I have no doubt whatsoever. Going through a rough patch, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I went to the Women's Stonehenge this morning, and, you know, here I am right now. But I love what you said, Tracy, or when you shared that your friend said, maybe we should go back and, you know, help some new people. And I think, so I got sober in San Francisco in the Bay Area, and I moved to El Paso, Texas almost 6 years ago. And it's a completely different place. And I, moving down here, I also decided, you know, I just don't believe. I've been acting as if my whole life so that I could just, you know, I'm married to somebody in the program. I mean, just so I could stay, I could still be. And I just reached a point where I just couldn't do that anymore. And AA down here is very, who talked about, was it you who talked about Florida? It's a very, not just God, but Jesus Christ. And, you know, in the Bay Area, I mean, yeah, there's God, but it's like, it's a whole nother thing. You know, it's not this and the judgment for not believing. So I haven't really, I've been doing secular. I'm not even sure how I finally got to secular. And I'm really grateful. What I am missing, though, are in-person meetings. And I want to try to figure out how to make an in-person meeting. I mean, I love Stonehenge. I love Zoom. This is amazing. You guys are all here. But man, I long for my people in person. And I did say out loud at meeting level one time that I just kind of like don't really believe anymore. And as you would imagine, there was the... but one young man came up to me after the meeting and he was like, oh my God. Well, oh my God. I know we keep saying, oh my God. But you know, like, wow, somebody else doesn't believe. So we haven't actually connected. But I do want to try that again. I've been thinking about Reddit or how, you know, like, how would I find other people, you know? I know there are other people in this town questioning their drinking. Just send me a message if you have any ideas. I do keep really strict anonymity. And it's interesting listening to a lot of this. So my husband and I have been sober a long time. But both our sons are sober as well. And the youngest one moved to El Paso, and he'll have 9 years in December. And man, not only is he like, you know, he got sober in Santa Cruz carrying a book around, but now he's going to church and going to Bible study every Sunday morning and meeting with the pastor and the reading the Bible, Tracy. I mean, it's like a whole thing. And, you know, we did the best we could. We were sober when we had our children, but we were fucked up. But we did the best we could. But, you know, he has so many resentments and like all kinds of things that I find really exhausting. And he hasn't reached a point in his sobriety where he can look at us and know that we really did the best that we could. And we're still married. We're still sober. It's been a shit show a lot of the times, you know, but we are here. All four of our children talk to us. They like each other. I mean, so it could be a whole lot worse, but I do struggle with this child who's will be 33, not really a child anymore. So anyway, I was listening to so many of these things because he's really stuck in his recovery too. And it's hard to watch people suffer. So anyway, that's like a lot. I just, you know, if only I had found you, you know, a really long time ago, I feel like I wouldn't have, struggled so long, even in sobriety. You know, I really tried to do it. And I had like health issues I didn't even know were happening. And my last sponsor, it was that thing of, you're just not willing. You're not trying hard enough. You're not, you know, fill in the blank. Well, shit, you know, like that's how I grew up, right? So of course I just, was it you who talked about being paralyzed? I become 5 years old again, and I'm so old to become 5 years old. It happens so much less, you know, it ruled my life. So anyway, thank you all. I just really appreciate being here and everything you've had to say.
Thank you, Peggy. And Jen B, you put your hand up.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jen B. Hi, Beth. Hugs, kisses. I love Beth. although I didn't relate much to her book because I am an egomaniac. But I read it and I loved it and I love you. And I've recommended it to numerous people who have thanked me up and down, left and right. So that's all good. The reason I raised my hand, though, was I wanted to reach out to Peggy, but I can't because the chat's closed. So I would love to help you figure out how to start a meeting. I have lots of resources for that. So if the powers that be could allow me to, to put my phone number in the chat, that would be great. If not.
Jen, we know each other.
Oh, you're the Peggy?
I'm Peggy.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So we already know each other.
Okay, I'll help you. Yeah,
cool.
All right, I'll send you stuff, lots of stuff, until you say stop sending me stuff. Thanks, everybody. Great meeting.
Hi, fam. My name is Lenny, and I'm a basic garden variety substance abuser, but it was alcohol that really took me down. Thank you, Beth. I was here earlier. For when I came in like 10 minutes late, and I was here for about an hour, and then my son needed to be fit, but whatever. Anyway, this isn't my first rodeo. I was sober for 8 years. I was out for 8 years. Now I've been back for, I always write it down every day, 5,337 days. But it wasn't until the pandemic that I found secular AA. And secular AA made me understand that I had a lot of friggin' work to do. And it was relearning those dirty little secrets. They weren't dirty little secrets, that being the odd guy out, that that convincing myself that every fucking kindness that I had created before I got sober was because I wanted something from somebody, that none of it was kind. It was all dramatization and manipulation because I was such a piece of shit and so totally selfish and self-centered. Now, through the years in my own observation in non-secular AA, I have found more often than not, and maybe just because I've talked to more women or observed more than men, I went to more women's meetings, there'll be more of that leaning toward that inferiority complex, that there's something wrong with me versus that, hey, my shit is ice cream kind of attitude. But all of that, that covering it up, and it's funny because I was raised Catholic, and at 7, I made my first communion, went to the castle, put on the party dress, and everything was fine and dandy. Had a big party at home. People gave me gifts, clothes, money. It was lovely. And then when I went back to school on Monday, everything had changed. All of a sudden, those little lost lambs, we were now friggin' sinners. I'm like, what the hell? So I just clung to my own idea of having a happy life. And I was never a good student, but I was great in catechism because I was going to feed them what they wanted instead of getting in trouble for not believing what they were telling me was the deal. And I also knew not to say anything to my family. Like, this is starting to sound pretty hokey. You know, I'm not sure I buy into this. But anyway. Just redoing stuff. I mean, doing a fourth step where Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, I justified totally unacceptable behavior from others. That list, I mean, it was just, I just painted myself with such a negative brush, and it was bullshit. It wasn't real. It wasn't honest. I was very fortunate. I had a sponsor who, as religious as this girl was, I mean, first generation New York City Irish Catholic street rat, but she never brought that in, even though she was in regular AA, even though she'd never heard of secular AA. The last thing she was going to do, and she called me out. She had enough sense to say, listen, you're painting yourself with, and so in a way, I had free therapy because I had a psychologist, but she died just before the pandemic. And I didn't know what the hell I was going to do. And then all of a sudden, I found secular AA on the internet. There was only one non-traditional meeting in my county. There's still only one. But all of a sudden, there it was. It was all over the place. It was in Zoom. I found my tribe. It was okay if I wasn't saying, hooray, baby Jesus. The odd thing is, even before I found it, what I'd always do at meetings, whenever there was somebody new, at the end of the meeting, all the women would line up and give her the earful and whatever. And I would wait until absolute last. And I'd go up to her and I'd give her my number. I'd say, if you wake at 2 a.m. and you're hugging your knees to your chest and you're crying and you don't know why, give me a call. It's good to have somebody in your back pocket who you know you can call round the clock. 9 times out of 10, that woman would wind up just talking away to me. 9 times out of 10, that'd be who'd go for coffee with me. That'd be, and I'd be that one who'd be like, I've got an ear. I'm not telling you anything. But in a way, I was like the protector of, it's okay if you're not buying into the baby Jesus thing, the God thing. And it was kind of like, I will make you comfortable there and put you at ease. And now there's this, there's secular AA. And here I am, I'm at a conference on the internet with people from all over the world who aren't going to guilt or shame me about not buying into the baby Jesus thing. How beautiful. Anyway, if nobody told you they love you today, think about that, man. I love you. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Lenny. Christina H., would you like to talk, please?
Yes. Hi, everyone. Christine, alcoholic. I am just so glad this meeting was here. I haven't cried in a meeting in a long time. And today was that night. Just everything that was shared just really touched me and made me realize I have so much work to do and that I think I'm ready to do it. I remember being a kid and I have the suspicion that I was being emotionally abused, but because no one had hit me, everyone kind of just like didn't believe that it was really as bad as it was. And oh, parents, you know, from back then just parented like that. And I guess that was supposed to make it okay. But sometimes I wish my dad had hit me because it would have caught more attention. And into realizing that something was wrong in our house. But it was a very hierarchy kind of system where it was like dad was on top, mom was codependent, all that stuff. And my mom started realizing too, once they became empty nesters, that he started trying to control her because she was the next one down on the totem pole and all the kids were gone. So she's learning to stand up more for herself. But it's just kind of sad how that had to happen for her to realize what was really going on. And yeah, it's been interesting to kind of unpack how I was raised with my mom. She was usually supportive, but I felt resentful at her for a long time for like letting it happen, for letting my dad call me the things that he did and basically rob me of any self-esteem whatsoever. And yeah, it's just a lot. There's just a lot of going around my brain, but I'm so grateful for this meeting and for this book and for everyone's shares, because this has really helped me to realize that I'm just not alone in that sort of stuff. And I need to hear that, you know, I really did. For a long time, it felt like I really was the only one because no one seemed to believe me. Or I seemed too dramatic or something. I don't know. It just got, you know, being gaslit constantly. So to go to a meeting where all these people are like, yeah, I know exactly what that's like. And there's even a book about it. Like, that just helps me so much more. And really opened a chapter for my recovery. So I want to thank you all so much for being here for this panel here. Thank you very much. Love you all.
Thank you, Christina. I'd just like to say thank you so much for coming to the meeting and, you know, turning up each week and bringing the book to life for me, because it's one thing to read something on your own, but when you go through with others, and then we're in this group of people now, and Beth came along as the author, but to me, Beth is part of the group. You know, you come along every week, and, you know, we're just this bunch of people having a go, and, you know, we're just kind to each other and trying to help each other. And that is AA. Well, that's the AA that I look for.
Hello, everyone. My name's Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to AA for being sober today. I want to congratulate Christine on 808 days. That's pretty awesome. And if anybody's new, and congratulations too. I heard Beth share earlier in a meeting, and I'm very interested in her book. I was brought up in South Africa, and I was brought up to fear two things, Black people and my parents, and more specifically, my mother. My mother was, her father died when she was 17, and she was never happy, I don't think, a day in her life after that. And she was a child abuser, both physically, both mentally. Although my father had gone to Harvard and got an MBA, our family was so fucked up that he called my mother mommy. So that made him either my brother or my dad, you know. So that was just, but that, you know, that was that. And, you know, the same lady gave me 10 cakes in a row in meetings, and then subsequently every 5 years until she passed, and my father's also passed October the 30th, which is coming up tomorrow. 4 years ago, my mother died, about 7 years ago. I'm bipolar. A lot of people say it's because of how I was brought up. The one thing that I just wanted to share was that they spent about $20,000 worth of money on therapy for me. And I came out of that knowing one thing: I'm good enough. I'm good enough just being who I am. Because my father had this little poem and it went like this: good, better, best, never shall I rest till my good is better and my better best. And, you know, an A in our family was average, a B was bad, and a C was crap. And they sent me to Beverly Hills High School from South Africa, where, you know, as I mentioned, I was brought up there. I was brought up homophobic. I was brought up racist. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, my computer's just frozen for a second here. You know, I really believe that love and tolerance of others is our code. The last thing I'm just going to share is, so one night I went to a meeting. This was probably about 10 years ago. And I was ranting about my mother and an argument that we'd had, which we always used to argue. After she died, I learned that it's better to be happy than right. But anyway, we were arguing and I just you know, dropped the rock at a meeting. And then afterwards, I was kind of like ashamed. I was like, why did I share that? And this woman came up to me afterwards and said, Jeff, I know exactly what you're feeling. You need to read this book. It's called The Borderline Mother. And I just like said, okay. And then she said, wait a minute, why don't you drive to my house and I'll give it to you. And I kid you not, I drove to a $20 million mansion. She didn't invite me in, but she did say, hold on. And I'm in the parking lot. She goes and gets the book and she gave it to me. And it describes these four mothers. One is the witch, one is the waif, one is the hermit, and one is the queen. And then there's all variations. And my mother was a hermit. She never went out of a 5-mile radius in the last 10 years of her life. She was a witch, you know, she hated everybody and everything. Everybody, nothing was ever good enough. And so I read the book and then I gave it to my sister. And then my sister's sister-in-law is in France and she sent the book to her. And that all came from a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The most spiritual thing I'll ever do is not take the first drink. Thank you for this meeting and thank you for letting me share.
Thank you. Well, I'm off and thank you all very much. Sunday afternoon, I got stuff to do.
Thank
please
you,
come Jake. To our meeting. Please come to our meeting. And